Reading Pennsylvania Times, January 6, 1920. Red Sox sell Babe Ruth to Yanks. The purchase of Babe Ruth, the star batsman of the Boston Americans, by the New York American Club was announced tonight by Colonel Jacob Rupert, president of the New York Club. Colonel Rupert refused to state the price paid. Colonel Rupert said that the manager Miller Huggins of the Yankees is now in Los Angeles, California, negotiating with Ruth. Ruth has a 3-year contract with the Boston Club made last season, calling for a salary of $10,000 a year. He is reported, however, to have declared recently that this sum was boosted to $20,000 and he would not return to Boston. The famous home run hitter demanded this increase on the strength of his last year's batting record, which when he broke all previous major league records by hitting 29 home runs. President Harry H. Frazee of the Boston Americans said tonight that he had sold Babe Ruth to the New York Americans because he thought it was an injustice to keep him with the Red Sox, who were fast becoming a one-man team. Mr. Frazee said that he would use the money obtained from the New York club for the purchase of other players and would try to develop the Red Sox into a winning team.
Hello, welcome to This Week in 1920s Baseball. I'm Josh Burke.
And I'm Matthew Rathfuss.
We're coming to you from the basement of the Bethlehem Area Public Library, where we are both librarians. We are also both baseball nerds.
Yeah, we love baseball history and we love talking about it. So we're going to talk about it to you.
And we were looking at, I guess, 100 years ago. Last year we were looking at how 1919 was such an influential season. And there were all these 100 years celebrations. If you know anything about baseball history, you know 1919 was the year famously known as the Black Sox scandal. The Chicago White Sox threw the World Series in order to take money from gamblers. And there's been a couple 100-year looksies-backsies that season. And we were kind of bummed that we missed that. So we said, what happened 100 years ago? And then we looked at the 1920 season and...
Yeah, I think we've
blew off our petticoats
before, but we had talked about doing more and we wanted to do something fun together. And I think this is a great way to look back at what we're both starting to realize is an incredibly historic season and very important for baseball history.
So here's what we're going to try to do is, okay, so we're calling it This Week in 1920s Baseball, even though there may be sued by Mal Allen's ghost.
We may also be sued for not giving it to you every week, but right. We'll try.
And our plan is to sort of follow the 1920 season, I want to say in real time, like each week as it unfolds. We're going to use the library's newspaper archives to pull up newspapers from 100 years ago. We're going to share those clips with you. We're going to give you our hot takes on the 1920 season, and we're going to watch the pennant race unfold. We're going to see if records are broken. I hear there's this new kid out of New York who's hitting some, what are they called, circuit swats?
Circuit swats.
We're really into
batsmen.
There's this hot batsman out of the New York American squad. We're really into the sports writing style of the 1920s. It's pretty great. So, let's jump right into it. This month in 1920s baseball was that batsman changing locations of whom I speak. Tell them what happened.
So, there was a batsman from Baltimore who played for the Boston Americans. You may have heard him before. Last name was Ruth. First name, George Herman. And he got sold. It's a bit of a thorn in the side of many of my fellow baseball fans, at least Red Sox fans, the history of that. So
100 years ago, Henry Frazee.
I think we'd established it was Frazee.
Henry, is that his first name? Henry Frazee, the owner of the
Harry Frazee.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Harry was the owner of the Red Sox. He had Ruth coming off of an amazing 1919 season. And he also, let's hear what Frazee had to say as to like why he made this move. So if you listen to Frazee himself, first of all, he said that Babe Ruth had a big ego. That was part of the problem. And he said, this is Frazee speaking in a contemporaneous newspaper account. I sold Ruth for the best interests of the Boston club, he explained. The Babe was not an influence for good or for team play. He thought only of himself, whether it was for the breaking of contracts or of making long hits. Sick burn. Sick burn on the Babe, for Z. He said that all Babe cared about was hitting long flies.
Yeah, he's just trying to put his spin on it.
Yes.
The money grubber.
And he claimed that he was trying to make the team better. So that was pretty clearly spin. But it is an interesting point. We were talking about, like, the rebuilds of contemporary teams. If the Sox, if you did have the hottest player in the land, and they didn't really do player swaps all that much, like trades, like player for, or they did they? I think they did.
I think they sometimes did, but I think the more common was just to sell the player because there was really no restrictions.
I heard that one of the things that was that Frazee said he didn't want specifically players back for Ruth because he felt like they would sort of be under this, like they would get booed essentially, and there'd be this shadow of like it'd be like almost embarrassing, like that's what you got for Ruth. So he just wanted that, but really,
I see that. But I mean, I did
that
see
that is a real thing.
But I did see something where I think he talked to the White Sox about like a cash deal, cash plus shoeless Joe Jackson, but it just wasn't enough cash because it sounds like really at the bottom of this is I think you'll get to is we have
so there's
a money interest.
First of all, we found something interesting, which is that in both the accounts of the day and current accounts, there's not total agreement in regards to how much the deal was for. You'll see it say $25,000. You'll see it say $125,000. You'll see it say $500,000. You'll see all these different numbers. But like you actually can find, not that long ago, the Hall of Fame's website posted the actual image of the contract or the promissory note, I guess is what it actually would be.
So I think we established that it was $100,000, right?
Yeah, so it was four payments of $25,000 from the Yanks. Rupert was that was the president of the Yankees, I think, and four $25,000 payments to the Boston American League Baseball Club, which was, I guess, their official name. The Red Sox was more of like a nickname that eventually became official. So there were the $25,000 first, and then three following $25,000 with some interest payments. So it ended up being a little bit over $100,000. But then, yeah, the big number was a $300,000 loan from the Yankees to Frazee personally in the form of a mortgage on Fenway Park. So Frazee owned the team, but he didn't own the stadium. And he was hemorrhaging money. A lot, some people know, and I kind of thought it was an urban legend, but the research I've done, he was a Broadway producer, and he was trying to finance some plays. He wasn't doing well. I think the one is called, like, No No Nanette. That's, like, the famous one.
Yeah, so that one may or may not be falsely attributed to this sale, because that one didn't actually premiere, I think, till 1925 or 1926, which was well after Frazee
sold the Sox.
The Sox. But there was a similar play, and I'm trying to find the name.
I wonder
right
why
now,
that one's become so well known.
Called My Lady Friends.
maybe that's why.
Which it opened in 1919.
That one's a stupid name.
Now, I think at the time, I don't know. I'm not a Broadway historian or anything, but I think at the time, that was like the thing. You know, if you could produce if you could produce a hit Broadway play, you were the talk
money
of the town.
Yeah.
You were the, you know, and it was
bigger than Hollywood.
It was like producing a Hollywood film today, I guess.
Yeah.
That would be the equivalent.
So Frazee claimed that his heart was in the interest of the club, but it wasn't. He wasn't trying to take this cash and sign some gems. There is an argument, and I've seen this argument a number of times, like, what's better to have like one superstar, studs and scrubs, or to have like a well-balanced team? There is a debate. It's not definitive. Even the analytics guys can't say for sure because too many things are unpredictable. If you had one star and he gets hurt, well, then your team sucks, right? If you have a bunch of average guys, well, then maybe no one's going to carry you. It depends who gets, you know, the season's too long, too unpredictable, too many things. Frazee had, I think he had a good spin on it when he said Ruth wasn't good for the team. Because, you know, we'd rather have a bunch of good players than one superstar and a bunch of...
Yeah,
that must have made the rest of the team feel
bad. I think if you take the no-no-no-net, the plays all out of it and the needing money out of it, if you just look at it from, like, a baseball executive perspective and you said, okay, like, take your heart out of it because let's say he's a fan favorite, but let's say, you know, it'd probably be a difficult decision if somebody was willing to give you that much money and you could reinvest it in the team, I think it would be a really difficult decision. I don't think it was an easy decision. I don't think it was a flippant decision either. I don't think he just, you know, I don't think it was all just about the money, honestly. I mean, I don't know.
I think it was. I think Verzee didn't care about winning ball games. And he spins it, though. He talks a good game, so maybe he meant it. And it's interesting you said, like, he was a fan favorite. Like, it's hard to remember, obviously, because his whole career, you picture him with the Yankees. But he was great with the Red Sox, Ruth was. I mean,
I think they set their attendance record in 1919.
And he was still a great pitcher at that point.
Yeah, I think we talked about this. He still did pitch. I think he started about 15 games in 1919.
So that was his last year as like a two-way player.
Left field. He played left field at Fenway Park.
Hmm.
I don't know who their right fielder was, but
yeah, that's a good question.
Pretty good.
So he, here's another from the newspaper article. From this is from the Wilkes-Barre Record, which I found. Every paper in the country covered this. Obviously, this was big news at the time. Ruth was 26 years old. He had joined the Red Sox, it says, in 1915 as a pitcher. Who was also used as a pinch hitter, which was pretty rare at that time, even, to be a two-way player like that. And last season, he was transferred to the outfield. So I guess in 19, he primarily played outfield but did a bunch of pitching. And then he hit the home run record, which was 29 home runs.
Yep, that's what I have.
And it says he made 12 three-base hits. 12 triples for Babe Ruth in 1919? Triples were kind of, the rules were a little different, I think, because of some of the, like, if the ball left the field of play in certain,
they may have called context. It a triple.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I think and also, so. Don't forget, a lot of these stadiums were, they weren't perfect arched.
And there were some that didn't even have a wall. The ball just would keep, the ball would just so, keep going. I
mean, if you could hit it past the center fielder, you could probably get a triple.
Here's the summation of his season. He made 12 three-base hits, 34 two-base hits, and received 101 bases on balls from pitchers who preferred to pass him. So he got walked 100 times, and they recognized that as a useful skill. So, you know, the OBP revolution isn't as new as we think it was. They knew that it was clutch, that Ruth was getting walked a lot of times.
Okay, so just, I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt this thought, but I guess who was in right field? Hall of Famer, Harry Hooper.
Harry Hooper.
I can see why they had it. Supposedly an incredible outfielder, Hall of Famer, elected in 1971. So, there you go. He was playing right field, and Ruth was playing left. So, yeah, so Ruth's statistics were amazing in 1919.
And the Sox fans loved them, and Frazee had to get out there and spin this story. I'm selling them to make the ball club better. And Ruth, for his part, said, no, I won't play anywhere but Boston. This is like, some of the quotes are funny because they're telegrams, so they're real. They quote the actual telegram. It says, will not play anywhere but Boston. Will leave for the East Monday. So that's from his manager, John Ego. It's funny because it's spelled two different ways in this one paragraph. I-G-O, I-G-O-E. Ruth's manager is out there sending telegrams, the tweets of its time. And Ruth said that the home run king had invested his money in the cigar business in Boston and naturally would desire to be there as much as possible. So he wanted to stay in Boston because of, what did he have, like a factory? Like, what did he, what investment in his cigar business? Who knows? But it was obviously a ton of money for the time. I read that, okay, so it was Tris Speaker, and it was, I forget who the other guy was, Eddie Collins, I want to say? Is that right? They were each sold for $50,000. Okay. So he doubled the previous asking price. And then also there was some debate about his salary. He was, that was part of Frazee's concern too. Not only, I think maybe that's part of why that number is like sometimes recorded differently, because not only did the Sox get $100,000, but they saved whatever Ruth's salary was, so they gave him straight up cash, plus they picked up his salary, which was maybe 15 or 20.
So about a year earlier he had signed for a 3-year contract for $10,000 per year, so $10,000 in 1919, 1920, and 1921. And almost immediately after that, he decided he wanted more money. So there was talk that he was going to sit out, I think, 1920 until they raised his salary. So I could see that as being another big issue for Frazee.
Yeah, especially if he's really trying to save money. He's not trying to have a star holdout, and he did not want to see that salary keep going northward because It's just funny, no matter what era of baseball you read, it's the same thing. The owners say, these salaries are getting out of control. Like, no matter what you look at. So, yeah, this article says $150,000, which is funny. That's incorrect. But it did say he made the record with 29 circuit swats.
Yeah, I mean, even this article says 125. And this is the New York Times, January 6th. But, again, it looks like it was 100,000. I'm trying to think. Do you have any idea how much that is today, in today's money?
No. We'll have to do the inflation calculator. I'm sure it's quite a bit. I also want to just share this side article that I found on the main article from the Philadelphia Inquirer. And I can't read the full article because it gets cut off, but the headline says, Wallace stands off Jack Sharkey. Jack Sharkey, that is a good 1920s name. Why are people's last names even cooler then? And then, now, the headline, the subhead, New Yorker lands lots of left-hand kidney punches on little local boy.
Mm.
So is that a boxing attribute of a grown man named Jack Sharkey and a child that was beat in the kidneys for entertainment of... Boxing was huge in 1920. That'll be different. That's a whole different subject.
Probably the bigger sport, right?
I think it was. Probably bigger than... Baseball was bigger than it is now, but it was... Yeah, the...
So I have the figure here. So it looks like it was about $1.3
million. What? That's not a bargain.
I think so, but I think in the equivalency...
Wait, $1 million or $1
billion? $1.3
million. Yeah, you're right. $1 billion would be a lot. What a bargain. For Z, Megan Bank. So we will continue to follow the... We decided it's not a hot stove. It's a hot tea.
The word we used was tea
kettle. The 1920s version, it's not like people didn't have stoves. The stove wasn't, but they did have
lots of... The wood stove league.
The smoking stove. No, the hot tea kettle. I like that. The other, I found a lot... So in between, after the story about Babe Ruth, this is just a tiny story, and I'm sure it means nothing, but there's this Philly story I found. It said, pitcher Roy Sanders picked up by locals through waiver route. Roy Sanders, a recruit of the Pittsburgh Pirates, became the property of the Phillies yesterday. And then it says Canders, because they spelled Sanders wrong. Sanders was secured through the waiver line. He's a right-hander, but was never given much of a chance to show with the Pirates. The Phillies paid the waiver price at the suggestion of Babby Cravath. That is a name, too. Who wired from California that the youngster was worth giving a trial this spring. So Babby Cravath, scout out there in California, sees Roy Sanders, who'd been cut by the Pirates, throwing smoke in some sort of wood stove league, and wires back to Philly and says, give this kid a shot. The Phillies, we do know, were really bad.
They were terrible. We looked at the roster, and we didn't recognize one player.
So we're going to... You know, obviously we know some things that happened this season already, but we know the Phillies are bad. We know the A's are bad. We know the White Sox are coming off the championship, so they're good. We know the Indians are good. They have Tris Speaker, right? Mm-hmm. They have some really good players. So, there's a lot of names that I recognize. Like, when I was young, I used to play this, like, baseball simulator video game called Micro League Baseball, and you could just create players by literally manually inputting their stats. So my friends and I would just, like, look through the baseball encyclopedia to try to find, like, crazy stat lines. And then, or we'd look, there's records, so you could see whoever had the most triples one year or whatever. And then we would have a draft. We would draft our team out of this reference book. Yeah. And then we would input the players one by one. And you could pick the player.
I'm so jealous. I want to play that.
Yeah, hey, I think we can find a Micro League Simulator online. I think it's out there. And you could pick a player, and then you could pick their year. But only one version of that player. So... Somebody couldn't be both, like, 19... You couldn't have both 2 years of Ruth on your team. But if you drafted Ruth, you could pick whichever year of Ruth you wanted. Yes. So, like, his 60 home run season is not even...
Yeah, I think it was, like, 23 was his, like, best year.
Because he hit over 350.
There was one where he hit, like, 380 and, like...
And then you see the doubles.
59 home runs.
And you see the triples. And then he was just phenomenal. So, so that's why I know one of their names. I know we're going to... come across his year is George Sisler, who was a phenomenal average hitter. I mean, hit for average.
He had the hits record for many years until each year.
Sisler had the career, and he hit 400. Obviously, Shoeless Joe was still a stud at this time. And
And we have some great pitchers to talk about, like Walter Johnson.
And we also, in 1920, have the formation of the commissioner's office. There's a lot of interesting off-the-field stuff, too, in response to the Black Sox scandal. It's also...
How the baseballs changed.
The ball itself. There's a tragedy, on-field tragedy. One of a kind... We're not going to tell you more until later. We don't know what happened yet. It's only January 1920. It's not... The season has not yet begun. We're still in the hot kettle phase of the season. We'll definitely have to do some other research, because 1920 was also when what's his name, the great leader of the Negro Leagues, I think that might have been Rube, I forget his name, I gotta look it up, but that was the first like sort of unified Negro League season, was 1920.
There had been
lots of other black baseball happening prior to 1920, but this was like a landmark in organization at the national level of the Negro Leagues. So that's like a whole parallel season. Obviously, you could follow the phenomenal stars and intrigue.
That.
So yeah, we'll dig up some of the Negro League history as well. So this is your hot kettle take from January 1920. We will update you as other possible signings happen and big news takes place. We will try to get the word batsman used in the contemporary parlance as much as possible, and also circuit swats. And I'm sure we'll find lots of other great language, lots of great names.
So are we podsmen then?
Yeah.
Podcastmen?
Podsmen. Yes. If podcasts existed in 1920, the practitioners would be called podsmen. On that note, this is Podsman Josh Burke signing out from the Bethlehem Librarians.
And this is Matthew Offis. Thanks so much.
Podsman.
Hey, Podsman Matt here. Thanks for listening. To our one listener, we can be found on Twitter at 1920s Baseball. Up next, we were planning an episode on the Negro Leagues, and the name of the player that Josh was trying to think of was indeed Rube Foster. We might also discuss Gavi Cactus Cravath, known to the Podsman as Gravy Cravings, and may even give you our gravy picks. Will it be white or brown? See you next time on 1920s Baseball.